Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Rumors of its death were clearly exaggerated. Harry Reid resurrected the public option today. And the healthcare debate? Oh yeah, it continues. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. 7 million K-12 students are enrolled in school districts that use software from SunGard Public Sector. More information at sunguard.com. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 26th of October today, and it is great to have you with us. Just to bring everybody back up to speed on the healthcare debate, seeing as how it's been a while since it's been top of the news, two different Senate committees came up with two different bills earlier this year. Among the more critical differences was this. One had a public option, a government-run insurance program. One didn't. The public option was largely written off after the Senate Finance Committee didn't include it in its bill. But today, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid wrote it right back in again.
The best way to move forward is to include a public option with the opt-out provision for states.
Reid announced he's sending a bill with the public option in it to the Congressional Budget Office so they can figure out how much it might cost. Cutting those costs is what we've been promised a health care bill will do. And Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports now from Washington there are plenty of places to trim.
A government-run health care plan is far from a done deal, but health care policy experts say if it becomes law, it would go a long way towards slashing health care costs. Jonathan Oberlander teaches health policy at the University of North Carolina.
The private insurers would be forced to respond because they wouldn't want to lose market share to the government plan. And so you might set up a system of competition between private and public insurers that could lower costs.
Oberlander says the government would have tremendous bargaining power to reduce the costs of care and medication, but there's still a lot of waste that's not addressed by Congress. A Thomson Reuters report out today says the U.S. healthcare system wastes about $700 billion every year. The report says unnecessary care accounts for more than a third of excess costs. Congress touches on that, but the focus of the overhaul is insurance.
This is really an insurance extension bill.
Uwe Reinhardt is an economist at Princeton. He says it's easier for Congress to focus on the uninsured. The problem with eliminating health care waste is one person's waste is another's income.
The Hill is full of people with money bags handing out money to prevent cost containment because they read that as income containment.
Jim Kessler is founder of Third Way, a centrist think tank. He says lobbyists sometimes work against each other.
Doctors and hospitals might have a differing viewpoint on reimbursement rates and how those are structured compared to insurers. You know, they're not all rowing in the same direction.
Kessler says lawmakers could take advantage of that to nibble away at the edges of healthcare waste. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Speaking of things we haven't heard about in Washington for a while, Too Big to Fail is back. The chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Sheila Bair, brought that phrase back today. She told a banking conference that there is a growing consensus over ways to dismantle banks and other financial institutions that are bigger than they ought to be. We're expecting to hear something about this from Congress as soon as tomorrow, a plan perhaps that would force big banks and brokers and insurance companies to set aside extra reserves, keep more money in the bank as a hedge against bad times. And if the times get too bad, the plan would give Washington more power to get rid of management and restructure debts. Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports that the legislation would also oblige big banks to write up something like a living will.
The proposal would require each big financial company to come up with a plan for its own demise in the event of a crisis. Big firms would have to show how their investments and debts would be covered if they fail. Stephen Lerner with the Service Employees International Union says the requirement will protect taxpayers.
If you can't describe, if your deals go bad, how it's going to get resolved without tanking the entire economy, then that's a problem. So we have to get out of this trap where no matter what the banks do, we get stuck here with the burden.
If big banks add innovative and possibly risky products or investments to their portfolios, they would have to update their living wills. Scott Talbot with the Financial Services Roundtable thinks the requirement is a good idea, but says the industry has a concern about too much disclosure.
The challenge will be that you want to provide the markets with enough detail that they have certainty that your plan makes sense, but at the same time, you also don't want to give away competitive advantages and corporate secrets.
Perhaps it would be better if regulators themselves put together the roadmaps for unraveling, says finance professor Kevin Jakes at Baldwin Wallace College.
What you want is you want the government regulators to have a plan in place that basically says to these institutions, if you take too much risk, if you get yourself into too much trouble, we're going to allow you to fail and we're going to unwind you.
The proposal will have a congressional hearing on Thursday. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Given the way circulation numbers read today, nobody would accuse American newspapers of being too big to fail. The Audit Bureau of Circulation, that's the group that keeps track of these sorts of things, said average daily circulation fell 10% this spring and summer compared to last. That in and of itself is not such a surprise, but the pace of that circulation decline is accelerating, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
Since newspaper sales started dropping in the early 90s, publishers have had to do more with less. Rick Edmonds follows the industry for the Poynter Institute. He says things got especially bad in the last year. The financial crisis forced businesses to pull newspaper advertisements, even if they felt they were still getting a bang for their buck.
That really puts the heat on to make even further cuts. And my sense is that readers are quite sensitive to changes that seem to reduce quality.
And readers today are more important than ever to newspapers' bottom lines. Vince Casanova is the Senior Vice President for Publishing Operations at Tribune Publishing. That's the company that owns the Chicago Tribune and the LA Times. He says subscriptions and newsstand sales now make up a bigger slice of the revenue pie.
They're a larger share of the total revenue stream than we had in the past for two reasons. One, we've raised prices, and two, overall advertising revenues are down.
Casanova says Tribune newspapers are focusing diminishing resources on what they think readers want: strong local coverage and good investigative reporting. But still, who wants to pay twice as much for a paper half as thick? Media blogger Dan Kennedy says the Boston Globe is operating with about 60% of the news staff it had a decade ago, and yet, he says,
the Globe recently raised the price of seven-day home delivery to almost $50 a month. We can't afford that.
Kennedy says he's cut back to just Sundays. He reads the rest of the week's editions online for next to nothing. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, things were good before they got bad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I've said before that I don't do scary movies, so there is absolutely zero chance that I'm going to go see a film called Paranormal Activity. My personal issues aside, though, the movie is going gangbusters. Paramount has already made more than $60 million from it. Not bad for an indie film that costs a studio just $300,000 to buy. This being Hollywood we're talking about, Paramount is said to be considering a sequel. But is that really a good idea? I mean, we all remember the Blair Witch Project, right? But does anybody remember Blair Witch 2? Anyone? Bob? Bob Moon?
I seem to recall the Blair Witch Project grossed $140 million a decade ago, but I'd almost forgotten its sequel took in just $26 million. So when the head of Paramount says the studio's already considering a sequel to a movie that's so reminiscent of Blair Witch, you don't have to search far to find skeptics.
It had to be a guerrilla movie made in somebody's garage, or it wouldn't be what it was. And I think if the studios tried to make it, it would be a big, bloated, star-laden flop.
John Horn follows the movie business for the Los Angeles Times. He says DreamWorks and Paramount wanted to remake the original movie into a full-budget production and release this version only as a bonus feature on the DVD.
The studios are largely incapable of doing anything on a small scale, and that's been, you know, a huge problem for them. They are much better equipped and have the aptitude and interest and kind of institutional knowledge to do movies like Star Trek or Transformers or Harry Potter.
Box office analysts credit much of this movie's success to a savvy marketing campaign, which got a mostly young audience spreading the word through Twitter and Facebook.
Where do you think that came from?
Shh, wait.
Anyone down here?
There's another problem with doing a sequel anywhere near the claimed $15,000 production cost of the original. Paul DeGarabedian watches box office returns for Hollywood.com.
Whenever this happens, when you have a film that's an unexpected hit with a low budget, inevitably everybody's price tag goes up, and it's virtually impossible to recreate a movie like that for that budget.
Even so, DeGarabedian says with the phenomenal success of this movie, Paramount would be foolish not to consider Paranormal Activity 2.
They've made so much money off the first one, they have some, you know, gambling money to work with here, and I think it's worth a shot.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Stuart Brand is as close to an iconic figure as the sustainability movement has. 40 years ago, he came up with the idea for the Whole Earth Catalog, kind of a how-to guide for the environmentally minded. Whole Earth became a byword for sustainable living, and Stuart Brand became known for this idea that human progress depends on some deeply individual ideas about technology and development. That perception of him may be about to change. He's got a new book out. It's called Whole Earth Discipline this time. It's called An Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto. In it, he outlines solutions to the climate change problem that might catch some of his old friends off guard. Stuart Brand, it's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Why this book at this time?
I think the realization that my fellow environmentalists had been wrong about a couple of issues and were getting in the way of important things we should be doing, both with biotechnology and with nuclear technology, and in terms of how we think about cities, and in terms of how I know we're going to think about geoengineering, that is direct intervention in the climate. All of those issues needed to be rethought at a deep level, and that's what I tried to set in motion.
Let's break some of those out and talk about them. Urbanization, first of all. You are now a fan, basically, of big cities.
Not only big cities, but big slums. The squatter cities where a billion people live now and a billion people more live, that are coming, that's how they're getting out of poverty. They're emptying out a lot of the subsistence farms that have been tough on the landscape all over the world, moving into town for opportunity, building jobs for each other. They're also moving up the what's called the energy ladder toward more and better grid electricity. By and large, cities are probably the greenest thing that humans do.
Did you ever think in a million years you'd be saying something like that? Cities are the greenest thing we could ever do?
You know, I was part of the back to the land thing. In fact, I guess I encouraged a fair amount of it with the Whole Earth Catalog in the 60s and 70s. And most of us went back to the land then, bounced pretty hard, and came back to town within 2 or 3 years, having learned all sorts of important things.
Let's continue with the list of things you advocate in this book. Genetically modified crops or genetic engineering? How does that make sense from an environmentalist point of view?
Already the crops that we have now, the herbicide tolerant and the insect resistant crops like BT corn and BT cotton and so on, are cutting back on pesticide use, which is terrific. The herbicide tolerant ones mean that you don't need to plow every year, and so you're getting what amounts to higher yield, so you can raise more food on less land, and all of that is good for ecology in general and the climate in particular.
I will use the language of critics of genetically modified crops here and say, but what we have, Stuart Brand, is Frankenfoods.
Yeah, and Frankenfood is a refers to a fictional romantic story in the 19th century. And the idea there was that Dr. Frankenstein was doing something against nature and that somehow genetically engineered food crops are against nature. And as a biologist, I'm just baffled by that line of argument because agriculture has been, in that sense, against nature for 10,000 years. That we've finally able to do more precise tuning of the crops is a huge gain, not a loss.
You are the guy who came up with the idea for the Whole Earth Catalog 40-some-odd years ago. Chart your progression for me, would you, from a guy who writes something like that to a book called Whole Earth Discipline, an eco-pragmatist manifesto. I mean, what happened?
What's different is in that one, I focused on individual empowerment And in this one, the focus is on the aggregate effects of humans on things like climate. And some of these issues are of such scale that you've got to have governments doing things like making carbon expensive or making coal expensive to burn and putting all that carbon into the atmosphere. And individuals can't do that. Individual communities can't do that. It takes national governments.
Is there anything we can do that's going to get it done in time? I mean, I know that's kind of a pessimistic question, but...
I think we'll probably have to step across a couple of too late lines. Events tend to change behavior. You realize that it's just going to keep getting worse unless you do something. And I think that's what we're going to have to go through before you really get the level of action that's called for.
Stuart Brand, you knew him first as the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog. He's got a new book out. It's called Whole Earth Discipline. Mr. Brand, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, and thank you.
Coming up, the dirty business of treasure hunting.
Not only is there damage to the site, the physical damage, there's also the loss to the archaeological record of those finds as well. From an archaeological perspective, it's an absolute nightmare.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials dropped 104 points today, 1% closed at 9,867, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ down 12 points, 0.5%, finished at 2141. The S&P 500 shaved off 12 points, 0.1%, ended things at 1,066. 1,066, Too big to fail, financial institutions took a hit because of concerns about potential Washington regulation. Bank of America unloaded 5%, J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo both cashed out about 3%. Goldman Sachs was down 0.5%. Radio Shack bolted up almost 16% today after beating third quarter sales estimates. Bond prices rose. When that happens, the yield on the 10-year TINA goes down, in this case, to 3.56%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them. The Economist, on newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Tuesday. The Senate Environment Committee holds a hearing on global climate change with Energy Secretary Stephen Chu, EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, and others. J Street, a pro-Israel and pro-peace political action lobby, holds its first national conference. The event will be held in Washington, D.C. And please remember that etiquette expert Emily Post was born on this day in 1872. Thank you. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Usually when we've got an author on the show, it's to talk about the book. They get publicity. We get to talk about their ideas with them. Today, something a little bit different. An interview not about the book so much, but about the publishing of it. Chuck Klosterman is here. You might know him from his earlier books. Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs is probably the best known. He is out with a new collection of essays about everything from America's relationship with ABBA to the offensiveness of laugh tracks, perhaps not mainstream publishing fair. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
First things first, in an interview that will be a little bit about this book, but a lot about publishing this book, one of the things you have to think about when you're coming up with a book that you're going to put on the market and publish is the title. Where did this one come from?
Initially, I was going to call the book just Eat the Dinosaur, which I thought, you know, could maybe become some kind of strange slang possibly for failure if the book did poorly. But then I was convinced that eating the dinosaur seemed more active, as if, in a way, I talk a lot about sort of old dying media, newspapers, conventional television, the old music industry. You know, they always talk about newspapers being a dinosaur and anything non-new media being, you know, dinosaur-like. Mm-hmm. Since this is sort of a last attempt to sort of examine some of these ideas, I guess I am technically eating that dinosaur.
So you were hoping to get eating the dinosaur to be the new phrase, jumping the shark, right?
Well, no, because I hate that phrase, jumping the shark. I guess I would hate it if eating the dinosaur became a new jumping the shark.
You're a guy who, with your track record, could probably, you know, go to your publisher and say, I'm going to scribble some stuff on the back of a cereal box and I want you to publish it. And they would probably, you know, think about it for a second, but then they'd say, all right, Chuck. What's the process like when you get a book idea and you go into your publisher and say, here's what I want to do?
It's strange because it definitely changes, you know. The first time you try to sell a book when I was putting together Fraggle Rock City, it was a book that when I you know, I didn't know anyone in New York or anything. I just kind of stumbled into an agent. And even though that book was almost finished when I submitted it, we didn't tell them that. We just took out the best parts and made it into a proposal. Because when you try to sell a book the first time, the proposal, weirdly, is actually way more important than the book itself. Hmm. But after that, it changes entirely. I haven't really written a book proposal in any of the previous four beyond sort of what I guess in Hollywood would be considered like a treatment.
Now that you have this relationship with a publishing company, and you're you're a proven guy and you're a performer and your books sell in varying degrees, does that give you more freedom to write more of what you want?
Absolutely. It really does. That is one of the big things about the world that I realize now that I would have disagreed with when I was younger. I used to think that to have freedom, you can't have any relationship with anything that with anybody else. And that's not really true, because the thing you really need to be able to write what you want is sort of the support of somebody who's going to say, like, well, as long as this is commercially feasible for us, we will allow you to be the person that you want to be or whatever. I mean, you look at a band like U2. U2 has more freedom than any indie rock artist there is. I mean, U2 can literally make any record they want. Yeah. They could make a record of droning. They could have a record that has droning, but also with, like, Eddie Van Halen guest playing guitar. Like, they could actually create whatever world that they desire. Radiohead's the same way.
So which was it in this book? Was it the chapter on the Unabomber or David Koresh and Nirvana or Ira Glass and Errol Morris in the beginning? I mean, did you put something in here that maybe you wouldn't have?
No, I just write about the ideas that are interesting to me. I have found that any time I've ever attempted to try to figure out what will be interesting to other people, it becomes very transparent and it fails.
Hmm. Chuck Klosterman, his latest book, collection of essays, is called Eating the Dinosaur. Chuck, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to give it a read, we've got an excerpt on our website. It's marketplace.org. Remember that haul of buried treasure that was found over in the UK last month? I don't think you can say the shine has worn off the hundreds of pieces that were discovered in a field near Birmingham, England, but the hard work has definitely started. A team of experts at the Birmingham Museum has begun cataloging and assessing the collection that was found by a guy walking around with a metal detector. He stands to net millions of dollars from his discovery, which has in turn fueled a mini boom in metal detecting, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
People don't usually line up to get into a museum, but every day they've been queuing in the hundreds outside the Birmingham Museum, waiting eagerly to see the Anglo-Saxon treasure. This is the finest hoard of Anglo-Saxon artifacts ever discovered. It's believed to be battle plunder, a sword hilt covered with gold, part of a helmet, more than 1,500 individual pieces, some encrusted with precious stones. Museum curator David Simmons is almost lost for words.
It's just incredible. It's the kind of thing that you spend 30 years working in a museum and think, wouldn't it be nice to see one of these? But you never do. And then suddenly there it is.
And this was how it was found. With a metal detector. It was unearthed in a field by an unemployed 55-year-old named Terry Herbert.
I was quite shocked. I didn't know what it was first.
Speaking briefly at a news conference in the museum, Herbert paid tribute to his trusty metal detector.
14 years ago, I bought a machine. It still finds items at really good depths, and it's been more fun than winning the lottery.
The find is expected to fetch more than $10 million. The sum will be shared equally between Herbert and the farmer who owns the land where he made his discovery. These riches have put the spotlight on the 50,000 Brits who make a hobby out of metal detecting.
OK, let's have a little look around.
Julian Evan Hart lives just north of London. He's been searching for buried treasure on farmland around his home for 30 years. He's never yet stumbled on the big one. Really important discoveries are very rare.
A major significant find is probably once or twice every 10 years. So does that confirm the madness of the metal detectors wandering around in the rain and the drizzle and the snow? Most likely, yes, it probably does.
But Julian has found thousands of individual items of interest and some value. His small home is packed with artifacts, Bronze Age axe heads and many, many coins, Roman and medieval.
And this really is a beautiful example. This is Edward III, and it's a gold half noble. A beautiful coin, and just look at the yellowness of that gold. That's pure gold, and that's a detectorist dream.
The coin is worth around $3,000. The prospect of finds like this has brought out the so-called nighthawks.
Nighthawking is kind of a glamorous term, I suppose, given to people that are basically thieves.
Michael Lewis of the British Museum says nighthawks are giving metal detecting a bad name. They operate illegally at night without the landowner's permission, looting finds and selling them on the black market. They cause untold archaeological harm.
Digging massive holes, shoving loads of soil into bags. Not only is there damage to the site, the physical damage, there's also the loss to the archaeological record of those finds as well. From an archaeological perspective, it's an absolute nightmare.
But Lewis concedes nighthawks are small in number. The vast majority of metal detectors operate legally, like the man who found the Anglo-Saxon hoard and like Julian Evan Hart.
Let's have a look at that. And there, look at that. A Victorian penny.
And frankly, not worth a dime. The search for the big one goes on. In a field about 30 miles north of London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a last taste of the bank-induced economic meltdown in Iceland last year. McDonald's announced today it's going to be closing up shop in Reykjavik and environs. The collapse of the Icelandic krona after the financial crisis ate away at its profits margins is what happened, the company said. One other currency-related thought for you before we go. The dollar got a break today. Had its best day against the euro since August. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow down 104 points, 1%. The Nasdaq fell 12 points. That's about a half percent. The S&P 500 shimmied down 9 points, 8 tenths of 1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the program, we start our series, The Climate Race, special coverage of the economic, political, and human dimensions of climate change. Part one, fears of global warming become reality.
There's a saying that there are no atheists in foxholes. I think there's something along that line happening here. I mean, there are still people that refuse to believe it, but I think there's been an erosion of that disbelief.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.